always thought that was you singing at this part.
No, it's not me. La, 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 la. Linoleum knife. No, it's not me singing. One time I sang.
Now I know.
I sang one time just as a goof. Very much like the way you just did.
And you received nothing but angry comments.
Well, not from the listeners.
Damn right.
From my co-host.
Oh, really?
Yes. He was like, why are you ruining everything? Because that's what he does.
Who are you?
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema. My name is Dave White. I'm a film critic for linoleum-knife.com.
Woot.
Alonzo Duralde, he ain't here.
As you may have noticed.
He's being the president of the Queer Lion jury at the 76th or 77th, I don't know.
One of the Venice Film Festival.
Venice International Film Festival.
Yeah. So cool. It's kind of a big deal.
It's quite a big deal.
Yeah. He's way better than both of us.
He's gone for 12 days. Yeah. He is way better. That's everyone already knows that.
Well, yeah.
Everyone already knows that.
Have you been in his presence?
A lot.
Yeah.
Until recently, when he flew out of the country.
He has more hair than both of us, a fuller beard than I, and a lovely singing voice.
He's. I tell you what he does.
Please.
Alonzo Duralde sings to me. Aww. Yeah.
In what context?
Whenever he feels like it.
Ah.
Yeah. You don't hear it on this podcast.
That's a shame.
He sings to me. It's real nice.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Usually it's some old-timey song that I've never heard of before. I'm like, what song is that? And he'll be like, it's I Concentrate on You, the Lena Horne version.
Oh, ho, ho.
Yeah. And consequently, I've grown to love that song. That's a marriage secret that I'm telling on this podcast of the cinema.
And Alonzo isn't here to defend
himself. No, he's not here to defend
himself. Who's here in Alonzo's stead?
You are here, William Bibbiani, boss of Crave Online.
No, I am really not the
almost
boss of Crave.
Boss of Crave Online.
If I was the boss of Crave Online, that's what I'd be. I do the film stuff.
I
am in charge of the film stuff.
Are you the editor?
Except when they do stuff without me.
Are you the editor of things?
I think my official title is the film content editor at Crave Online. But I am a film critic, and I host the B-Movies podcast,
yes.
And I do a lot of reviews on What the Flick with Alonzo Duralde. We review a lot of TV together and so forth. So that's me.
It's great to have you here as my guest.
Thank you, Dave White. You are nice. And if you hear a very lovely laugh in the background, that is my lady friend. Dave has invited Michelle and I to his lovely abode where we are going to eat food that Alonzo Duralde will not eat.
He's mad about it, too.
He's mad about it?
Yeah.
He wants to be here and not eat it?
No. When I posted on Facebook yesterday that the woman at sacking the groceries at the grocery store was throwing shade at me about my dry rub, which she did.
Throwing shade about your dry rub is a really,
really
great sentence.
She goes, so what kind of rub are you using? And I was like, just dry rub. She goes, did you make it yourself? It's like, no, I bought it. She's like, you know that face?
Yeah.
That condescending face.
Yeah. That's like your... Yeah.
It's just like, I make my own. And I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. I haven't done that. I just bought a jar. And I didn't want to get into it, but like I was like, look, I bought a jar at Monsieur Marcel, the gourmet shop, so I think my rub is going to be okay.
And her response was, mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, no, she just looked at me, and she goes, I'm sure it's going to be fine. She goes, homemade is better, but she goes, I understand that it's buying it is more convenient.
Wow.
And I was like... Now I've failed everything. I apologize to both of you that I have not constructed my own dry rub.
If you want to find out how how good Dave's dry rubs are, you can find out by following me on Twitter at William DeBiani. Yeah. I will be tweeting about Dave's dry rub.
Good.
And that he gave me.
Yes.
Yeah.
The but I'll tell you what I did do. I did. Here's what I made from scratch that y'all are fixing to eat after we do this podcast. Mm-hmm. I made cornbread from the Huckleberry Cookbook. You're welcome.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No, okay.
And I made some.
Sold.
I made some ranch dressing for salad. I make.
That's for her.
I make that salad dressing.
She's going to have that.
He hates ranch.
I don't hate ranch.
Do you
I don't
really?
Particularly care for ranch.
Interesting.
He mocks it.
I will dip a carrot in a ranch dressing if the mood partakes me.
What about ranch dressing is not your thing?
I don't like dressing, like on a salad. Oh. I don't like ruining a salad by putting liquid on it.
What do you do to it?
I eat it.
You just eat the leaves.
I eat the leaves. It's, yeah. I want, like,
I do
earth.
That too.
I want to eat something pure and naturey. Like, I want to, like,
put your mouth
yeah.
in the dirt.
I just, like, you know, I want to, like, you know, like there's still elves
Gnaw
attached to it, and I just
carrot.
Chew and crunch.
All right.
And it is delicious. I had a less interesting supermarket excursion today. We will review movies at some point.
You bought drinks.
I bought drinks.
The people who listen to this show, they know.
Yeah.
That the movie reviews come along.
That when they happen.
When they come along.
Yeah, yeah. I was at the supermarket today. Dave, I asked Dave, I said, Dave, you are being so kind. You are making us the food and things.
Yeah.
I should bring beverages.
Yes.
And Dave was like, I was going to go out and get the beverages. And I was like, no, I will get the beverages. Yeah.
Keep doing the impersonation of me.
Yeah. No, it's good.
I'm always up for everyone else's. Everybody that I know has an impersonation of my voice.
No one can do it just right. It's been a while since I've been able to do it in public, but I have, of course, many a time called Dave.
Keep going.
The Velvet Lawnmower. Anyway, so he said, nah. And I said, no, let me bring you drinks and things. And so I went to the market, and Michelle was waiting in the car, and I just ran in, grabbed some beverages, but I went to the beverage/potato chips aisle.
Right.
Where it was like gridlocked with like 40-something pudgy guys in hats.
It's Labor Day weekend.
And bros.
Yeah.
You ruined my twist ending.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because my initial thought was, what is this? And then I started, like, looking around me, and it was like you could see, like, the camera, like, sort of move around me in 360 degrees as I began to suddenly become aware of my surroundings. And I realized there was sports stuff
right
in the building.
Yes.
And I was like, oh. So as I said, your story was better. And we can move on. We can move on.
I know you wanted to talk about Wes Craven.
Well, we can talk about whatever you
and
want,
Dave.
And I'm going
to close the door while you begin talking about Wes Craven.
Well, we lost a couple of titans of cinema.
He died.
But Wes Craven was one of them this
Jones.
Week. And Dean Jones. I was going to bring up
Express.
Dean Jones. Snowball Express, the ugly dachshund, million-dollar duck.
Yep.
Herbie, the various love bugs.
Well, those are films that all of those films I loved as a child. All those films were made when I was a child.
Yeah.
Those were vintage to you.
Yeah.
They were contemporary films for me at age, you know, 7.
Well, Dean Jones clearly is where your passion is. Let's talk about Dean Jones. So on the B-Movies podcast this week, Whitney and I were talking about just this fact.
Yes.
That, you know, to us, a lot of the Dean Jones movies were a little retro, but they used to play them on TV. They
I'm
would
just
be
not
on
getting the
of
sentence, Dean Jones is your passion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep talking.
Dean Jones' passion. In any case, Dean Jones movies used to be on TV a lot, along with the other sort of white hero. Like, if you, like, somewhere there is, like, Fred McMurray, Dean Jones, and Tommy Kirk
yeah.
are, like, represent 3 points of a triangle.
Yes.
And inside was Disney.
Yes.
And they used to be on TV. They used to be on in the middle of the day. They used to be on The Wonderful World of Disney in the evenings. We would see Herbie the Love Bug. We
yeah.
would see That Darn Cat.
Yes.
And now they don't seem to be on anymore.
No.
And I know you can find them. I'm
yeah.
sure kids can see. If parents
conscientious
take an interest,
parents will expose their children to these terrific movies.
Right. Oh, and of yeah. course, then in the female sort of the offshoot is Hayley Mills
yes.
and Annette Funicello.
Yes.
And someone else, I imagine.
Angela Lansbury.
Angela Lansbury slash whoever Mary Poppins.
And by terrific, I mean ridiculous.
Oh, they were silly as heck.
Delightful. Children's films.
Well, they were extremely what's the word I'm looking for? White. They were really white. And I don't mean just mean they had white people in them. Like they were blanched of anything even remotely edgy or offensive. It was I wasn't there in the 60s to appreciate this.
The closest you got were the Dexter Riley movies.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there was a trickle of G-rated flower power happening in the background.
Well, that's my thing. It's just, you look at the 1960s and it feels like there's only two things going on. Like, Easy Rider and Merlin Jones. Like, those are the two things. All right? Monkeys were either going home or, like, Warren Beatty was getting shot in an old-timey car. Like, those are the two things going on in the 60s.
Monkeys Go Home is so good.
I was doing my research on Dean Jones for a very epic tweet.
I mean, so is Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, I will take the Pepsi challenge with any Dean Jones. Bonnie and Clyde is fine. It doesn't do it for me nearly as much as any of the Dean Jones. But I've seen Monkeys Go Home, but aside from a general sense that at some point the monkeys returned somewhere, I have no distinctive memory of Monkeys Go Home.
It was more like a cry of anguish. Monkeys go home! You know.
How dare you!
Yeah. Monkeys are taking over everything.
I had this...
Not in a Planet of the Apes way, in a playful, frolicking sort of way.
Well, that sounds cute.
They put on clothes and jump around and, you know, like maybe someone puts the clothes on them.
Monkeys jumping on the bed way.
They wreak monkey havoc.
Yeah.
I remember I had this incredible... You know like when like you have a memory of something and then it betrays you later on?
And you've remembered it wrong.
I remembered it wrong. And I had this when I realized all of a sudden that not every Dick Van Dyke movie was a Disney movie.
Right.
And Cold Turkey was not a Disney movie.
Correct.
Cold Turkey is a movie that I cannot believe has not been rediscovered.
It's a weird movie.
Cold Turkey is this wonderfully farcical movie about an entire town of people, all of whom smoke like a pack a day minimum.
Children.
And they all agree.
Even the kids.
And they all agree to quit smoking at the same time. And if you've ever been around anyone who's tried to quit smoking, they will kill you as soon as look at you. And it's just like, but imagine an entire town like that. And there are people who still have to do, like, brain surgery while they're trying to, like, just let him smoke. I'm like, just take that guy to another hospital. This can't be the only brain surgeon. Also, I'm not sure I trust a doctor who smokes that much. Like, that's a problem. In any case, Dean Jones died.
Yes.
And he seemed nice.
He also had a big, Broadway career. If Alonzo Duralde were here, he would talk to you about Dean Jones being in... the Sondheim play Company.
But he's not, so we should move on.
And he, But here's what you should watch sometime. Documentary film about the recording of the Company cast album. Because it's Dean Jones and Elaine Stritch and all these like great Broadway people all singing. And it's wonderful to watch. It's really, like, I had not seen it.
Yeah.
And Duralde for years is like, I'm going to show this to you. I'm going to make you sit down and watch this. And then he did.
Yeah.
And this was after taking me to UCLA to see Company performed by, you know, all these like
kids.
Famous, no, yeah, by children, a children's production.
Well, I don't know. It could be the UCLA Theater School doing. They do plays,
right? They do plays, and Isabelle Huppert comes and performs in them. I mean, that's
neat.
She wasn't in Company, but you know, other people.
Why did you go to Isabelle Huppert?
Because she did a thing at UCLA once. Well, you know, one woman play there once.
Well, good for
it was like entirely in French or something.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So no one knew what the heck was going on.
I knew some friends who didn't speak French who went to this play, and they were like, this was the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. So the...
Go on.
So Dean Jones died. That was sad.
Yes.
Wes Craven died. That was also very sad because...
That was a big deal.
You know, these guys are old, and so, of course, that's what happens when you get old. You die. But, you know, when someone who's really accomplished and cool dies, you feel bad about it. You're thinking, oh, that's sad. they did great things that I loved, you know.
Well, it's different. It's interesting because there's different kinds. There's people, there's celebrities who die, wonderful, talented people who die, and you feel bad about them dying, but they, like, hadn't done anything for a really long time. Like, yeah. I couldn't tell you the last time I saw Dean Jones in anything. He might have been in stuff, but
kind of retired-ish.
Yeah, he certainly wasn't starring in movies. So when Dean Jones died, there's a part of me, as I feel terrible admitting this, part of me was just like, he was alive?
Yeah.
But, like, still, he was Dean freaking Jones. Like, he seemed cool. So it was sad. Wes Craven was still making movies up until a couple of years ago. And, like, you know, a 3-4 year break for a filmmaker isn't that big a deal. So it still seemed like he was pretty vital.
Yeah.
So he died. He was 75 years old. That's a pretty good run.
That's not really, in my estimation, 75 is not old enough.
And no, well, it never is.
I think at 75, you're like, oh, you just retired and you're going to, you know, the Netherlands on a vacation. Like, at 75, you should still have a good 15 or 20 years left at 75.
That would be the dream,
You should be, people...
Especially in, like, when you have, like, an entertainment industry job, you probably have made millions off of the royalties alone from Nightmare on Elm Street. You probably can afford really good health care.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's one thing if you can't afford decent health care, but, like, this guy's rich. Your thought is, if he doesn't live to be at least like 91, we all got ripped off of like a decade and a half of Wes Craven. Yeah. And the thing with Wes Craven is that, you know, Wes Craven made a lot of junk in his career.
Yeah.
But every like 4 or 5 junky films, he would come out with a brilliant movie.
Something great.
Often that would redefine the entire horror genre.
Yeah.
So it always felt like, oh, Wes Craven, well, okay, his last couple of films were but he'll be back. And he won't. Because he died.
Right.
And that sucks, because he was great when he made great things.
Yeah.
I am a professional film critic. I have had to say so much about Wes Craven this week.
You've made the rounds.
I did.
In the
media
we talking about this.
I went on KCRW, Madeline Brand, press play. I went. We did a thing on What the Flick, and it was me, Alonzo, and Ben. And Alonzo and Ben both opened by saying we don't really watch horror. Everyone in the video was like,
Alonzo really does not watch. Very he doesn't many horror films.
No.
He's not into it
because he gets scared.
Some
people avoid horror because they get emotionally fragile.
He does not get scared. He's easily grossed out.
Ah, okay, that's different.
Gore and killing bothers him.
Yeah.
Gore and killing delight me, and so he and I have had this ongoing 20-year thing where he's like, I can't watch this. I know you're going to eat it up, but I can't watch this.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's a lot he just doesn't want to... I'll tell you, you know what's fantastic?
Please.
Going to... some terrible PG-13 horror movie with Alonzo is the best thing, because they don't have anything in PG-13 horror. 99% of the time,
pretty tame,
has nothing but jump scares.
Yeah,
but ooh-wee, does Alonzo Duralde not like a jump scare? Because they always get him.
Well, it's interesting. I remember
when I sit there and I know they're coming, so I just sit there, and when one happens, I go, yeah, that just happened. And he goes, and he jumps in his seat.
It's this interesting thing, though.
It's
where
great to watch.
Film critics who aren't really big on horror, not just Alonzo, when a film critic reviews most films, it comes from a place of immense understanding. We've seen so many films just like it.
Yes.
Maybe we know if it's good or bad or not, but there's a certain amount of, we're a little bit immune.
Yeah.
If there's a genre you're not really into, whether it's horror or whatever,
right.
you come at it from a place that's a lot more like the general audience member.
I think that's true.
So that you watch something that's actually like pretty generic and crap, like Ouija.
Yeah.
And Alonzo will like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember if he liked it or not.
He liked it okay.
Oh, yeah.
He was fine with it.
I was bored out of my gourd.
I could not stand any part of that movie. Dave, what was your favorite Wes Craven movie?
Oh.
If you had to pick.
Well.
You can do it.
Last House on the Left.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not a given.
Because it's...
it's scuzz.
It's scuzzy. And it's so
gross.
It's so... it makes you feel so bad. And
well, yeah.
And here's my favorite thing about horror.
Yeah.
I don't want a happy ending. I want to feel bad about what I just watched. I want to walk away from it thinking, the world is terrible. And people are murderers, and then they do bad things, and then you try to get revenge, and you just make it worse. And it's about Vietnam too. And, so that, you know, that's what I like about it. Yeah.
What do you get out of that? Like, what is the,
just a great, awful feeling.
What was that? We were watching,
and then I get over it because immediately after the film, there's something to eat.
Michelle and I were watching some Doctor Who, and there's a line in a Doctor Who episode called "Blink," which is also a great horror story.
Yeah.
Which was sadness is happiness for smart people. And it's a good line.
Yeah.
And I thought of Dave.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, because my favorite, that's my jam. A bummer movie is, boy, that's the best thing. And not necessarily a horror kind of bummer, but just a movie that leaves me feeling like the world is in decline.
Yeah.
caveat, it must be well made. It can't be beautiful, you know, because that's a bummer.
Yeah.
That movie is a bummer. B-I-U-T-I, whatever it's
Irish. Yeah, Alejandro González Iñárritu.
Javier Bardem, one of the worst movies I've seen in the past 5 years.
It is so pornographically sad.
Yeah.
Which, I guess, if that's your thing, if you really just want to see how close you can go,
the
slitting your wrists in an hour and a half.
I'm not talking about that.
Yeah, no. You want to...
computer.
Well, with horror, there's this sort of, just sort of playing around in the fields of villainy and evil.
Yeah.
And then you leave. Beautiful is a film that tells you, yes, but isn't it beautiful how we're all doomed and nothing will ever go right? And it's actually, and you know what the thing that Beautiful is? It feels like a murder movie.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, this guy, he's dying for all of your sins. No, he's not. He's just being manipulated by a really crass and hacky filmmaker.
If you're playing bingo right now with this podcast, I'm about to talk about Bresson, but... Balthazar and Diary of a Country Priest.
Wait, Ohazard Balthazar?
Yes.
Okay.
Ohazard Balthazar.
Just checking. Could have been one of the other Balthazars.
And Diary of a Country Priest.
Okay.
Those are devastatingly sad films.
Mm-hmm.
But they're so satisfying. And so, you know, they make you feel like you're full of something great when it's over. And that's the non-horror version of what I'm talking about.
I'm kind of like Alonzo, but is to horror I am too sad.
Yeah,
because I'm sad enough as it is.
Right.
I don't tend to. I will watch it, and sometimes I will love it and I appreciate it. But then I don't want to own it. I don't feel the need to own something that made me incredibly weep. It wasn't that sad, but Nebraska depressed the hell out of me. Alexander Payne's Nebraska. The tale of the guy and his dad, and they never quite got the thingy, and dad's old, and I got to my car and I wept afterwards. It didn't help that it was 4 months after my dad died.
Oh yeah, don't go see any movie about parents after your parents die. Yeah. That is not the way to head, though.
It's interesting. There's these life experiences you have that completely change the way you view movies.
Yeah.
After a while. When you're a kid and you're watching movies about romance or sex, it seems kind of funny and silly, and then you realize, oh no, wait, that actually happens.
Yeah.
And your entire perspective changes, and then your parents start dying, and all those really tear-jerky death scenes that seem so shallow and manipulative, they work now all of a sudden.
Oh,
it's
God.
Really weird.
5 months after my mother died, I had to review...
Oh no.
The Guilt Trip.
With Seth Rogen and Barbara Streisand.
Seth Rogen and Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
And I first of all, I did not hate that film.
It's not a terrible movie. It's a little silly, but
it's
like
silly
it's cackneyed, but
they,
it's cute.
They have this nice, you know, chemistry in the movie together.
Yeah.
And but at the end of the film, she says to him, as they're about to part ways, he's going home and she's going back to her home. She says, "If I could choose a son, I would choose you."
Oh.
And I was like, "I'm gonna cry. my mommy's dead." And so on the way out to Bibbs is holding my hand right now. On the way out to the car, Alonzo is like, are you okay? I was like, I miss my mom.
Yeah.
And I wrote the review, and I remember in the review writing about my mother's death and being I was like, I have no idea if this is a good film or not. Because my mother just died. And this movie has just jammed down hard that button. And I don't even know if I'm watching a good film or a bad film.
What was your comments section like on that?
Oh, sorry about your mom, Dave. You suck! Basically one of the two.
Yeah.
One of the two.
There's the really sensitive internet, and then there's the actual internet. You got a good cross-section.
Yeah. Pretty much. Someone actually directed me to comments on that. They were like, you go look at these comments.
I'm curious if but then you think about, there's a lot of like, so The Guilt Trip was it's a cute, silly movie, but it's very melodramatic. It's about guys and their moms and that relationship, and obviously they're going for the emotion.
Yeah.
And then there are some movies that just just throw in like a parenting subplot thinking, oh, this'll get you.
Yeah.
Like The Transporter Refueled. Segway.
Right.
In which, like,
yeah, we're just finally talking about this week's crap movies.
Mostly crap movies. Yeah. So in The Transporter Refueled, the transporter gets a dad. Turns out he had a dad this whole time.
A real sexy dad, too.
It's Ray Stevenson. He is a hunk. He's great. He's such a fun, good actor.
I normally don't go down this road, but Ray Stevenson.
I will say this.
Ray Stevenson.
Here's my thing. I have a long and storied history of sort of sexual confusion when it comes to the Transporter movies.
He is sex father, Ray Stevenson.
Because it's like all of the sexiness that Jason Statham had got moved to Ray Stevenson. Except there's one that he has like a mole on his chest that is so distracting. Like, I want him to get it checked out.
It's fine.
Like, I'm worried about... No, I'm worried about him. It does not look like normal shaped.
It looks just like it should look.
Okay.
Yeah.
The mole is what does it for you, isn't it?
No.
Okay.
It's the whole... Look, he was Punisher Warzone. That is all that matters.
He was the best Punisher we have ever had.
He was the best Punisher.
He's such a great... I've often said that if you take the three Punisher movies and jam them up together, you've got a good Punisher movie.
Yeah.
You just need Ray Stevenson and then, like, the plot and the direction of the Dolph Lundgren one. And then there's something from the Thomas Jane one I kind of like. I can't even remember. There's something. It's not terrible.
Talking over you.
Go.
I walked into Punisher Warzone because they had not screened it.
Yeah.
For the press. And I didn't even know who was in it. I was like, I'm walking into this blind. And I see him and I'm like, oh, Ray Stevenson is the Punisher Warzone. I'm so excited. Like, and that... It could have been some other person playing
the Punisher Warzone.
Punisher Warzone. Mm-hmm. But
I like to think that Dolph Lundgren played Punisher War Journal. Trying to remember the other names of Punisher comics.
War Reporter.
No. He had War Journal. That was the whole thing. It was like from the perspective of his diary, the entire series. That was a good comic.
Okay, so Ray Stevenson
Transporter Dad.
Transporter Father, yeah.
And Ed Scrine.
Scrine, yeah.
There's a new transporter in town, and he's playing the old transporter, but younger, but years later.
He's newish. He was in Ill Manners, which I have on a DVD that I'm not able to watch because it's region UK.
And he was in a couple episodes of Game of Thrones before he was recast.
Yes.
What was interesting was everyone was saying, like, oh, and then he left the Game of Thrones so he could star in the Transporter movies because he signed on for multiple films. They're taking a gamble on this kid. And
they should not have gambled it that way.
Well, here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
What was interesting was... When there was like some press thing like this week, and they were talking to Ed Skrein about it, and he said Skrein. Anyway, they said like, "Oh,
Ed.
Ed, yeah. Our good friend Ed, was said like, yo, so you left Game of Thrones to do Transporter movies, and he denied it and just said like, no, I guess they got rid of me or something." And I'm just like, maybe you should have just taken that. Like, they gave you a little gift. Right. Gave you agency. Like, I took a gamble on my career. It's like, no, I got fired and I had to do Transporter movies.
Right.
That's kind of what he's just said.
Right.
And he is no Jason Statham.
No, he ain't.
He is not the first two Transporter movies are gifts from God. If there is a God, those were his gifts lately.
And here's why.
Yeah.
Statham is a man.
Yes.
Yeah. And
Michelle and I watched all of these movies recently.
Young Ed is you know, Nicholas Holt plus 10 years and a little bit of stubble.
You just get no... there's no indication that he knows that he's ever done anything before in his life. Yeah. Like, he just sort of he just sort of imagined his way into a movie. There's no past. There's no history. There's no, like, I know how to handle any situation.
He takes off his shirt, and you're like, son, I know the transporter's chest very well.
You, sir, have no transporter's chest.
You ain't got that. That is not what you are.
Yeah.
You're a little wiry. You need a little more...
Well, he looks like a model. He doesn't look like a fighter.
On yourself,
he looks like a model, and he even I swear to God, he's wearing more lipstick in this movie than any of the women.
He got some nice pouty lips.
He has some super pouty lips. But one of the things, but what was weird about it is you got this model guy. He had his super pouty lips that you're at least covering them in gloss. That is not natural sheen.
Yes. Yeah.
And you take away the gay subtext.
I know.
That made the transporter so wonderful.
I know.
And like what that's. You've taken away everything good. The transporter had, like, good stunts, gay subtext, and Jason Statham. Those are the three things it had.
Yeah, when a man is too pretty, out goes the sexiness. That's gone. Yeah.
I mean, like, you can appreciate, but it's like appreciating a stained glass window. You don't want to have sex with it. You can just sort of, like, look at it and just go, nice.
That's a nice stained glass
window. Yeah, that's kind of Ed's scream. So there's this movie, and he's in it, and it's not very good. And
here's what happens.
Tell people the plot of The Transporter Refueled.
Young women.
Yes.
Who have been sexually exploited and
sold into sexual slavery.
Sold into sex slavery. They suffer through it off screen and
For
many years. And then they grow up and they all become the four lady musketeers.
Because they've read the Three Musketeers.
It looks like they've read. Like the Three Musketeers for young readers,
like the Reader's Digest version. Yeah.
Like the copy that they have of it, like that they somehow, for whatever reason, carry around with them.
Well, they cut to the copy of the book when they mention it, just so you know. Just so you gotta, they actually read, so they didn't see the movie.
Yeah.
Like, they read the book. Good for them. They're smart. Smart girls.
I want to know if they, like, passed it around and, like, read passages to each other.
Yeah.
But the literal copy of the book that they use in the film looks like it was, you know, here's the Three Musketeers for fourth graders, you know.
Yeah.
It's the sort of abridged version for kids.
Yeah.
And so they grow up and they're going to take revenge on the organized crime bros who have ruined their lives.
Of course.
And so
they should.
They become murderesses. And they hire the transporter.
Now, I want to say this right now. That's not a bad idea.
No, it is not.
For like
a
grindhousey kind of like sleazy action movie, that's a decent fun idea.
I like the Fury Road, Angel's Revenge sort of, you know, the aspect of that.
Like the Aaron Spelling movie.
No, the Angel, the schoolgirl by day, prostitute by night from the 80s.
And then
she's in other Angel movies. I think one of them's called Angel's Revenge.
There's an Angel's Revenge, which was where Jack Palance was a drug dealer.
No, not the MST.
Oh, okay.
I got the title wrong. Angel, right. Angel.
Okay.
Angel. Anyway, that's a feminist plot.
Yeah.
And
they could not have made this movie less feminist if they tried.
And here is then what they do. We're going to spoil this. This is a film that deserves to be spoiled. This is not even like Sinister 2, don't worry about that.
It's like, there's not a twist in it.
No.
It goes where you think it's going to go.
Right, yeah.
There's nothing unexpected in this movie.
There's no twist. All there is a deeply flawed understanding of how women want to use their bodies,
or how anyone would.
Yeah,
I'm not talking specifically about
women, because this is a film about women.
But I'm not talking about. Listen, there are sex workers out there who love their jobs, who went into it willingly.
That is true.
They're porn stars, prostitutes, whatever their gig is, and they enjoy it, and that's a perfectly valid life decision. And God bless them.
Yes,
these specific characters were sold into sexual slavery by their family
as children,
and then. After, like, they do, like, a particularly successful heist thingy, they tell their sob stories to the transporter while they're undressing him to reward him with sex.
Yes.
They are commoditizing their bodies while they are trying to get revenge against men for commoditizing their bodies.
Yes.
And I just think to myself, if you look at this and Transporter 3, the transporter cannot have heterosexual sex in these movies without it being really creepy.
Yeah.
Every single time he does, it is wrong in some way.
One of them finds herself shot by a gun close to the end of the film. And they don't take her to the hospital. They perform homemade surgery on
emergency
her.
Emergency triage with, like, flamey cobwebs.
And sugar.
And she sticks around. She's fine.
Yeah. This is like an hour later. An hour after she's been shot, bleeding out in the back of a car, emergency triage with flame and cobwebs.
She's ready for sexy three-way.
With Ray Stevenson. Now, in all fairness, I know, like, oh, I've had such a bad day, I was shot. On the other hand, Ray Stevenson wants to have a three-way.
Right.
You're conflicted, and maybe you give it a shot. But you don't, like, fling yourself around the bed all giggly-like.
The next day, when the movie's over, and they're all dressed back up in their sexy clothes.
Yeah.
And they're waving goodbye to the transporter. There she is, looking great.
Yeah. Like, she's fine. And there's a flesh wound, like, oh, this grazed my arm. She was shot in the stomach. They had to reach into her stomach. There's a close-up of them pulling a bullet out of her guts.
Yeah.
It's a flesh wound. All of her flesh.
Right.
They got all of it.
Yeah.
Like, she shouldn't be. I'm willing to accept that she's alive. I'm willing to accept this silly cobweb thing, which, if that's real, please, someone link
any
me.
Any doctors listening?
I need to know if that's real.
Cobwebs
coagulate the blood.
Coagulate your blood.
It's an olden timey thing.
Is that actually a thing?
Yes, it is. But, you know, dust isn't inherently sanitary either.
So
this isn't like the best way to.
This is like emergency battlefield stuff. And So
what we can learn from this plot detail is that.
Oh, please tell me.
Sex with Ray Stevenson.
Heals the sick.
Fixes everything.
I love it when movies teach you things. Often they teach you wrong things, like or they teach you things that were thought to be believed many years ago, and now they're like every serial killer movie believes that anyone who was abused as a child becomes a serial killer.
Yeah.
Like, and you're just like, that's not how that works. We would all be serial killers. There's no way. But
his business after the closing credits is sex doctor. So Ray.
Yeah.
I've got vitiligo.
Yeah.
Can I have sex with you and fix it?
I feel like that's what's going to happen in the future on Steven Universe, if anyone watches that show. If anyone watches that show, that's a Steven Universe thing. I was going through this, but I love it. Like, I remember when, like, Face Off came out, and it was like, when you stab someone, you twist the knife so the wound can't close.
Right.
I don't know if that's true, but I do know that Face Off told me that, and I know that if I have to stab someone, I am going to twist that knife.
Yeah, so that you can win the Face Off.
So I can win the Face Off.
Yeah.
Against John Travolta. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I mean, like, there's some funny. Here's the thing. The transporter revealed, like, there's some fun stuff in it. Like, I like the bit where the transporter, like, after four movies and two seasons of a TV show, he finally ghost rides the whip.
Yes.
Like, finally. Like, oh, he puts the car in neutral, lets it roll, beats up a whole bunch of guys, and then before the car hits anything, he gets back in the car and plows through it.
And the prostitutes are in the car going, oh no, what's going to happen? Like, well, y'all could get out of the car if you wanted to. You could jump out. It's moving fairly slowly.
Yeah. And then I like that the plan, this incredibly elaborate plan, like, one of the things that keeps this movie from ever really feeling like it gets going is because the plot is, it's not complicated, but they keep the motivation from us for so long that we can't latch on to anyone. We don't know who we're supposed to care about. And then it all turns out that the plan was unnecessarily elaborate, and all it boiled down to was all we have to really do is kill these guys and cut off their thumbs. That's all we have to do. Like, you could have totally just, that would have been the entire thing. They were together earlier on. All you had to do is just go, oh, hey, pow, 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 pow. And we're good.
And then
the movie's over.
There you go, your thumbs. We're going to tag them, color code them, so that we know
which is weird because
which thumb belongs to who.
Crime in the universe of the Transporter Refueled is actually very straightforward. The first scene in the movie is this guy taking over all of prostitution in the French Riviera by pulling up in a car, like going up to two pimps, killing two pimps, and then just say, now I control all the crime, all the prostitution in the French Riviera. And they put like two girls out on the street, have fun, and then they leave. And that's it. That's all it takes. And the best part for that for me was, you don't even realize this for a while, the movie then cuts to 15 years later.
Yeah.
When one of the girls, played by Loan Chabanel, very lovely young lady, I think she's an okay actress.
Yeah.
It's 15 years later, she hasn't aged a day, and then she says that she was 12 when that happened.
Right.
No, you were not.
She was a 32-year-old 12-year-old.
Yeah. And looks amazing for 32 years old. You don't look 12.
Right.
Yeah. You don't look 12. So the transmittery field, not very good.
So boring, in fact.
Yeah.
That during the climactic chasing, fighting, killing sequence near the end, it dozed off.
You dozed off?
Yeah.
There's two good bits in that ending. There's this one jet ski bit where the jet ski goes on land, which they ripped off from the Transporter 2.
Yes.
And then there's this bit where this guy has, like, scissors.
There's a
scissors.
Jet ski battle at the end of From Justin to Kelly, too, by the way.
Good. There's this guy, like, the guy's, like, trying to kill the Transporter with scissors, and the Transporter picks up a rock. And Michelle and I were just like, rock beats scissors!
Rock beats scissors all the
good
time.
Research.
Yeah.
It's not very good. It's not as bad as the Transporter 3, but it's also not as good as the Transporter television series or the Transporter 1 or 2.
I have not watched the television series.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun little, like, episodic Knight Rider kind of thing. It's perfectly decent. When there's a good episode, it's a really good episode. And when it's not, you eat dinner while watching it and it's fine.
So then there was A Walk in the Woods.
Yes. So, so there's all these wonderful actors in the world. There are people right now, this week, we just talked about Dean Jones died. Sad. Wes Craven died.
Yes.
Sad. And usually when a super talented person dies, it's very rare that this isn't the case.
Yes.
Their last movie sucked.
Oh,
you notice that 90% of the time, someone's last movie
is
lame.
Nick Nolte Death Watch, then.
Yeah, like seriously, you watch this movie, it's like, and you just want A Walk in the Woods. It's not anyone's worst movie. In anyone, everyone involved has made worse movies.
Yes,
but at the same time, all you can think of is Nick Nolte looks so frail and emphysematic. And you just think to yourself, please don't let this be Nick Nolte's last movie.
I'm legitimately
he could have quit
worried.
After Warrior, and he would have been fine.
I'm legitimately worried about Nick Nolte.
He does not seem well. Like, it's uncomfortable to watch the
entire
movie.
Film. I sat through the whole movie. Yes, yeah. Uncomfortable to watch the movie. I sat through the whole movie alone, by the way, in the theater. they did not screen it for me.
They didn't screen it for most people, even though it played at Sundance.
Yeah. I sat through the whole movie, and in my head, it was becoming a horror film because I was so scared for Nick Nolte's well-being. I think that there was a stunt double for every scene in which he was not sitting.
Yeah, when he walked, you got the impression.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a moment where he took a stumble in one scene, and then the hand covers the face, and I was like, well, this is very clearly the stunt double.
Because if that's
doing this almost not even a stunt.
If that's the case, here's the thing. If that's not a stunt double, watching this movie is like watching Roar.
Yeah.
You're just waiting for some, like, for the lion to strike.
Yes.
If you haven't seen Roar, by the way, I know you guys talked about it in your podcast. It's amazing you have to see Roar. Michelle and I watched it. Wasn't it the scariest thing you've ever seen in your life?
It was. It was terrifying.
You just wild
in
cats.
In a good way. Yeah.
In a good way, but like, holy crap.
Why don't you explain the plot of this movie?
Okay, so A Walk in the Woods is it's based on a true story. It's adapted from a book by Bill Bryson, who's apparently a very prolific travel writer. I'm not familiar with his work. Fair enough.
Me neither.
Okay. But fair enough. Good for him. He went to places, and he got people to pay him money to talk about it.
Right.
We do the same thing for movies.
Ish.
Yeah. I saw a movie. I'm going to tell you about it after you give me money. That's my gig, so I'm not going to complain. In any case, he's old.
Yep.
And he realizes that he's old, and he decides to hike the Appalachian Trail for reasons that are never adequately described
correct.
In the movie.
That's
it's not
correct.
Like someone says, you can't do it. It's not like someone says, well, you know, if you're a real man, you'd blah. He doesn't make a bet. He just says, oh, I should do this. And everyone's like, why would you do that? And he's like, I don't know. And like, I don't care.
His radiant, charming Emma Thompson wife.
She's amazing.
Would love him not to do it. She's afraid for him. She's worried for
and
him.
And legitimately thinks, so. He's not young. She thinks
he's going to die. He's like 70 whatever years old.
Yeah. He's healthy for his age, but
she's
still.
Emma Thompson. And in your head, you are thinking about it. Why are you going to leave Emma Thompson?
To do anything. Emma Thompson is a miracle.
What, every day of her life, she's a miracle.
Yeah.
And you see Robert Redford. She actually says to him before he leaves, I love you. And here's what Robert Redford does in response.
What?
He kind of half smiles at her.
The lack of appreciation.
He doesn't even say, I love you too. Like, he just kind of smiles and walks away. And I thought, well, you don't deserve it.
Yeah, screw you.
Robert Redford.
You know, it's interesting. Like, movies have what is called an inciting incident.
Yeah.
There's your life.
Yeah.
And then something happens, and now this is worth making a movie about because this inciting incident happened.
Yeah.
And usually there's a period of debate. Do I take the call to adventure? Do I stay with my wonderful wife?
Right.
There's got to be some motive for you to go do this. You know, if someone told me, you know, hey, you have two options. You can hike the Appalachian Trail, or you can stay and hang out with your wonderful girlfriend. I'm picking option B.
Right.
Because that sounds nicer to me.
Right, yes.
There's no motivation for him to do this. There's no one that's like, you're not going to like, oh, you'll lose your job, you'll lose your pension, you're not going to like, there's nothing at stake, so we don't care, and it doesn't feel dramatic. Yeah. This doesn't have to be like Wild, where he's trying to get over heroin addiction or something.
Right.
And there's just got to be a reason for him to go, and there's none. And then Emma Thompson's just like, well, you can't go alone.
Yeah.
So he picks someone who could be of absolutely no assistance to him if he ever got in trouble to go with him, and that's Nick Nolte's character, who is like an ex-alcoholic. And it's really funny that he's attracted to fat chicks.
Right.
You have a Safe for Work podcast. There's a certain word I can't say.
Yes.
Off is my response to that. Like,
You can say F off.
F off. Nick Fine. Nolte's I feel character. Like a child saying that, but okay.
Yeah.
There's a movie here. There's a movie here in which two excellent older actors spend time together in the woods and consider the wonders of nature and talk about all the adventures they've been in their lives.
And the estrangement that they have developed over the years.
They haven't seen each other in like decades.
That is never really investigated.
Not really.
At all. They rely on like sort of cute little set pieces about, oh, we're gonna cross this river on these rocks. Oh, we fall down, go boom, get wet. Like that's
like two scenes.
Why don't
that happens twice?
Why don't you skip one of those scenes
and
then talk about why you have become estranged? Because they never really do.
They never really talk about anything you might remotely be interested in.
Back to Emma Thompson. After her three sentences, she's not in the film anymore.
She's gone!
Yeah.
For like 70 minutes!
Except at the end when she hugs Robert Redford and he comes home. And she's like, oh, I'm so glad you're alive. Like, the end.
He didn't call her! He didn't contact her!
Nope.
Apparently he didn't send her any letters.
Nope.
I would have remarried. Like, I would have just been like, he's been gone for 3 months and he's like 72 walking the Appalachian Trail. I'm not going to waste time. I'm still Emma Thompson. However old I am, I look like this and I have this personality. I can literally have my pick of anyone in Vermont or wherever the heck I am.
Yeah.
Like it's
Hanover, New Hampshire, by the way.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
It's just the movie is so like, it looks like they tried to take a thoughtful story about growing older, looking back on your life, exploring America, and they tried to turn it into Out to Sea. Not even Grumpy Old Men.
Right.
Out to Sea.
Yeah.
Which is a perfectly harmless movie with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau.
Yeah.
But it's the movie your grandparents drag you to.
Right.
And you're just so glad it wasn't worse. Like, that's kind of what this movie is. It's not the worst movie of the year, of the week, even. It's just sort of like, oh, please don't let this be their last movie, please.
Right.
Just like, don't go out on this.
But it could, based on Nick Nolte's physical presence, it could be. That man,
In the film,
yeah,
walks three paces and is wheezing.
He's winded.
He speaks as though he is choking on a wet towel.
And it's like, Nick Nolte has always had a gravelly voice.
That is true.
There's a difference between, you have a gravelly voice.
It makes me worried for myself. Will I naturally sound at age 75 or however the hell old he is?
Yeah.
Mike, I'm dying and something wet is caught inside me.
Nick Nolte has a carton of cigarettes a day for 30 years.
I guess.
I equated it on my own podcast. We did the B-Movies podcast, so we can review this as well. I equated this to, if you remember, just before Pete Postlethwaite died. Amazing.
Yeah.
He did a couple of movies where he looked so frail.
Yeah.
It was uncomfortable to watch him in Clash of the Titans. You think to yourself, these filmmakers are being irresponsible for asking him to be out of bed right now.
Right.
You know, like, it's rude. Especially for the Clash of the... Like, do The Town? Fine. All I had to do in The Town was sit down and trim flowers. Clash of the Titans, you wasted Pete Postlethwaite's, like, a month of his life.
It is.
At the end of his life.
Right.
Yeah.
It is simultaneously the least interesting film of 2015 and also one of the scariest films.
in a way, yeah.
Yeah. Because 30 minutes in, I thought, is there, like, a whole other hour of this? Because I want to go.
Well, there's this...
I took a picture of the screen. Like, I thought, I'm alone. I can just pick up. I'm just on the phone. Take a picture of the screen. Instagram about it. You know? Yeah.
Well, what's weird is that the movie is in the real story, and it's based on a true story, and it's not very plot heavy. So I don't mind telling you this.
Yes.
They don't hike all the way across America. These 70-plus-year-old men didn't make it from one end of the continent to the other.
Well, they go. It's like from Georgia to Maine.
They do okay. Yeah. Like they don't like not.
Right.
They don't like go like a day and quit. Like they go a long time. Good for them. But there's this bit where you're tracking their progress, and there's like they're in Georgia, and the movie's been going on for a solid 80 minutes, and you're thinking to yourself, oh my god, how long is this movie? How much longer is this gonna? When are they gonna like? This movie cannot possibly be long enough for them to get all the way home.
Right.
So they just quit. Right. They just have to, or do they die? Do the bears actually get them? Like, I don't. All right. Anyway, let's move on. So there's only one movie we want to talk about this week.
Yes.
And it's the good one.
It's
been the good one for about, like, what, 70 years?
It's
something
been the
like
good
that?
One for
60
years. Yeah. There is yet another theatrical reissue of Rififi.
Good. There can't be enough.
It's a 1955 movie from Jules Dassin. And he's actually, I think, American.
Is he? I didn't know that.
But he was blacklisted and
totally looking this up.
And he was blacklisted and he went to France. I did look this up. They reissued it in 2001, or 2000. I do remember that happening. But I didn't see it at that point.
Yeah.
If you want to watch this movie and the reissue isn't coming to your town, and it, you know, it might not. I don't know.
If you're in a big city, there's a decent chance. If you're not, and probably won't. But you can see it online.
Yeah. It's available. There's a nice Criterion.
And if it's on Criterion, I didn't look this up. There's a decent chance it's on Hulu if it's on Criterion because they have a deal with them. Shouldn't be too hard to track down.
The title is French slang for a fight.
Basically rough and tumble.
A rumble, a brawl.
Well, yeah.
And it's it comes from a French military word, meaning the combat zone.
Mm-hmm.
So it became this sort of street slang, and the title of the original novel is Un Rififi
chez les hommes.
And that means, roughly translated, a brawl among men, a fight amongst men.
Yes.
And that's what the film is about. These four guys, one of whom has been in prison for 5 years. He took the fall for one of the other guys, Jean Servais. He was a French actor whose career had actually kind of fallen on tough times because he was an alcoholic, and he died like 10 years after this movie was made.
Okay.
So he's the main guy, Tony Le Stéphanois. And
I want the rest of this podcast to just be you saying stuff in French.
Le Stéphanois. Going through the film, they're all like, get Le Stéphanois. Like, we're going to get him. It's his friend Joe, and this other guy, these two other guys, Italians, they plan a big heist. A next to impossible heist.
Mm-hmm.
They do the heist in this incredible, nearly 30-minute wordless heist sequence.
They have to be silent the entire time, and it's just nothing but the nuts and bolts of what they do.
It is a 2-hour film, almost full, like an hour and 55 minutes.
Yeah.
And a good near 30 minutes of that running time is taken up by the heist scene where there is no dialogue and no music.
Well,
it's just them doing
it. It just
heist.
Puts you right in the middle of
it's
in
incredible.
A way.
It's incredible.
Well, what's incredible is that Rafifi, it certainly wasn't the first heist movie in any technical way. It defined the way we do heist movies now.
It defined the way criminals do heists. There have been... I looked this up, too. Sweet. There have been actual crimes since the release of this film in 1955. Actual crimes, actual heists committed, patterned on this heist. Real criminals watched this movie, and they were like, It's like me watching The Barefoot Contessa. I could do that. I can make that salad. That seems fairly easy.
Yeah. But here's the thing is that what this movie is in a lot of ways, it's very nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
It's basically, okay, so here's these guys. We see their motivation. Got that out of the way real quick. Then let's do this heist. Okay, well, what are the problems with that heist? There's all these things. And we go through all of those things. Then we see them preparing all of those things.
Yeah.
We see them trying to figure out how to solve the problem of the alarm. That takes a while. And then it's just going through the heist, and it just puts you in the position, people at home, of like, here's the thrill and the boredom sometimes of actually doing this thing. And then there's like a whole conclusion because morality, people who commit crimes must not get away with it. There's always like that one person in a heist who like, oh, we got away with it, it's perfect, but this one guy and his, you know, loves his girlfriend so much that he does something stupid and like spends the money he shouldn't have spent.
He screws everything up.
Exactly.
And so these Italian mobsters.
Yeah.
They catch wind of what happened, and then they figure out, because of the guy who messed up, they figure out who did it, and they're going to go get that money. Because they're criminals. What do they care? Like, someone made a heist? Let's just go take their money.
Yeah.
We're all criminals.
These guys did this incredibly brilliant heist. All they got to do is put a gun to their head, and then they give us the money.
Yeah. So I won't go into any more detail as to what happens, but...
Can we talk about the world's most horrible child, at least?
It is amazing. This film, from start to finish, it is amazing. A noir that is half daytime and half nighttime. And this beautiful shots of, you know, Paris in 1955. You're out on the street with this. It's not even in a studio. They're out in the world shooting this film. And... The world's most horrible child.
There's a bit at the end. I'm not going to ruin it for you if you haven't seen Rafifi, because you should see Rafifi. Suffice it to say, at the beginning of the movie, you see that one of the guys has a kid.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why this older, this elder crime statesman took the fall.
Le Stéphanois.
Le Stéphanois took the fall for this
Tony,
other guy.
Tony Le Stéphanois.
Anyway, so this guy took the fall because this other guy had a kid and he didn't want to drive the guy of his dad. Okay, fine. And now, at some point, because it's Chekhov's child.
Yeah.
At some point, he has to get kidnapped.
Right.
And like, you know, like the kid's going to be in danger at some point. And the kid is just, at no point do you think, unless you have a blood relation to this kid,
right,
do you think to yourself, yeah, that kid's worth the $120 million they'll lose.
Francs.
Sorry, but like, still, like, you don't think to yourself, yeah, I'd pay for that kid.
Yeah,
Michelle and I, we left the theater, and my first thought was,
you can make a new kid.
We can make a new kid. We can adopt. Like, you say, oh, we'll give you your child back for 120 million francs, whatever. And a part of me is just like, I'm going to counteroffer.
This kid is kind of annoying.
Here's, I'm going to give you, I'm going to go down to $20, and we'll meet somewhere in the middle.
It's like that scene in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
No, wait, stop.
When someone says, "We have kidnapped your daughter, and you must give us your golden ticket," and the guy says, "Let me think about it."
Well, that was the thing. They didn't even have the golden ticket. They just had the chocolate bars.
Give us
all of your Wonka bars.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I have some time to think it over?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, you. That is correct.
That is great. No, but that's still basically the same thing.
But yeah, that is how I felt about that child. I was like, you know what? That kid is like 5 and already turning out to be a little bit of a pain.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Alonzo and I, we review The Strain every week over at What the Flick. And on The Strain, in particular this season, there's a kid who is so useless.
Yeah.
And so unwilling to accept the horrors that have befallen New York in that series. And he's so just like, oh, well, we have to, like, do this thing to kill all the vampires and save the world. But my mom! And you just slap! And you just don't... You don't care. And it's this thing... It's this interesting test of audience empathy.
Yeah.
Where it's like, if you don't have a kid who's just like that kid, not even have a kid, you have a kid who's just like that kid, to actually care if that kid lives or dies. Because at some level on the audience, you care about the plot. You care about the external circumstances more. Like, whenever you watch a movie and, like... It's like that scene in Last Action Hero where the kid's watching Hamlet, and Hamlet's about to kill his father. And then he's like, wait, I can't kill him now. If he's in the middle of confession, he'll go to heaven.
Yeah.
And then I'll be the monster. And he's thinking about the ramifications of violence. And meanwhile, this kid, who we're supposed to sympathize with, is like, don't talk, just do it!
Yeah.
And you just want to slap that kid. But that's us. In a lot of action movies. It's like, why didn't you just kill that guy? And then he won't come back later. And it's like, because the hero isn't a monster. Like, it's this weird conflict, and this kid, like, in reality, I don't want that kid hurt. That kid's a kid. That kid's a stupid little kid. He didn't deserve to die. But from the safe distance of watching other people deal with that kid, kill him! Kill the child! I don't care about the child! Because to me, all that child is getting in the way of these characters I've come to enjoy getting away with a heist that was really, really hard.
But
so it pisses me off.
In a way, it kind of purifies Stephen Waugh's character, though, because he's able to put up with this kid.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, he starts off
beating Mado, his
crap
girlfriend.
Out of his ex-girlfriend stuff.
And all fairness, she's kind of fine with it.
Well, I think she's fine with it.
In a French way.
Yeah. She's fine with it in a, what else do I have to look forward to? Sort of way.
Well, she knows she feels that she's done him wrong, so I feel like she's gonna let him have one. But like my whole thing, I'm watching this scene. This movie is very interesting because there are certain movies that have an attitude towards women.
Yeah,
like some movies obviously don't care for women very much.
This one has a French 1955 attitude.
Well, what's interesting is that it's not like usually in a movie that has an attitude towards women, women are all one thing in that movie, or all one of two things: either victims or villains or something. And in Rififi, there's really only 3 female characters, and they actually represent different things. Like, it's actually pretty... So there's this one woman who is... Well, I guess there's 4, but one of them is a very minor character. So this woman is, you know, she was a gangster's mall. She's clearly somewhat morally, iffy or whatever.
Right.
And she kind of lets this guy hurt her.
Yeah.
Doesn't put up much of a fight, just kind of lets it happen, whatever. And then she's mad, but then she doesn't even... Not that mad at him later in the film. And yet there's one of the Italians has the most wonderful girlfriend.
Yes.
Who's really just like this wonderfully like sexy, plump, funny woman who bathes him. But it doesn't feel like it's subservient. They feel like they're just wonderful together. They're cute.
Yeah.
There's this moment in like, and you notice like this in a lot of heist movies where like, you know, there's been all this build up and now there's got to be a moment where the heist is on. You know, like in Ocean's 11, the Steven Soderbergh version, it's the bit where Carl Reiner is like staring at a mirror and Brad Pitt says, okay, we gotta go. And then Carl Reiner puts on his game face and now the heist is on.
Yeah.
Everyone gets one of those moments in Rififi, but for that woman and her boyfriend, it's him like getting his hat, she's doing dishes, he walks in, she turns around, and he just pokes her in the nipple.
Yeah.
And it's like, boop, and then leaves.
And she's like, ooh.
Yeah. They're wonderful.
Yeah.
They're wonderful together. So yeah. I don't think the movie has an attitude to women, but it's weird.
Right.
It's a weird thing to watch nowadays.
The I went looking up the cast because a lot of the people in the cast, they weren't familiar faces to me.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that the showgirl character who who's the
she sings the song Rafifi.
She sings the song Rafifi. Viviane is her name. Magali Noel.
Yes, I know her from something.
You've known her for a lot of things because she, of all the cast, is the one who went on to be in, you know, really famous movies.
Was
in Fellini's Satyricon. Okay. She was in Amarcord. She was in La Dolce Vita. Ah. So she got around. She was in all kinds of stuff.
No one else.
Well, you know, the other people did go on and did other, you know.
But she broke out. She has a very small role in this movie.
She has a very small role, but
she only has like three scenes.
Right. But she's the one that you know, went on to be in a lot of films that you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good for her.
This is such a wonderful movie. It's just this great caper film.
It holds up well.
It's tense and it mounts itself really well.
There are certain movies.
It looks amazing all the time.
There are certain movies that are, I think they're important. There's a lot of classic movies out there. You watch Turner Classic Movies, there's no shortage of movies.
Right.
There are certain movies that are just, there were movies that were made before this movie, and then there are movies that were made after this movie.
Yeah.
Rafifi is one of those films.
Yeah.
So if you have even a casual interest in film history, just, you know, at some point you like to see an old movie because you heard the original Frankenstein was really important, or everyone keeps talking about Citizen Kane, you'll get to it eventually.
Right.
Rafifi is definitely one to get on the list, and if you get a chance to see it on the big screen, do it.
Yes.
It's great. This is a really great transfer.
Yeah.
It looks really, really, really nice. I would recommend it because it's good.
Yes.
I'm a professional film
critic. It's excellent.
All right, what else is left on the podcast?
Got a DVD recommendation?
Do I?
Won't you?
I will recommend. Okay. What is? Okay, I will recommend a recent release. If you're familiar with Scream Factory, they put out the best Blu-rays of like old horror movies, like 1980s type horror movies that people never thought would get released on DVD.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Right.
And they'll do a really, really nice transfer. They'll do a nice painted cover. They'll do great commentary tracks and features and everything like that. And they just a couple of weeks ago put out a fantastic edition of The People Under the Stairs.
Oh, nice.
Which is one of Wes Craven's better and also one of his least talked about movies. People Under the Stairs is about this white affluent couple who lives in their seclusion in a big giant house, and they own like a tenement building or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to foreclose on it, and they're going to put all these families out on the street. And then a couple of, you know, like this thief who happens to be black, and his nephew is also black as a little kid, they decide to sneak into this couple's house and steal stuff out of sort of 1% retribution. Then when they get inside, they realize that they are crazier and more violent and more dangerous than they are. The uncle gets murdered immediately. They don't know the kid's in the house. And now the kid's trapped in this fortress of a house with these two maniacs who we begin to realize are like incestuous. They're brother and sister, and they're married, and they have deformed kids living in the walls. Like, it's messed up.
All right, I'm watching this one.
This one, you haven't seen this one?
Nope.
It's fantastic. It's got Everett McGill, and I cannot remember her name. Remember Everett McGill from Twin Peaks?
Yes.
So the woman who played his wife in Twin Peaks plays his wife in this, and they're the villains.
Oh, good.
And it came out like a year after Twin Peaks. It was really, really weird. But this movie there's a certain righteous fury in this movie against the 1% and against like the sort of moral majority who, like, these people, they mutilate their kids based on whether or not they see evil, speak evil, or whatever. So they if they say something that they think is immoral, they cut out the kid's tongue. And you're like,
that's parenting.
It's so gross, and obviously it's very blunt, but it's effective, and it doesn't go where you think it's going to go. There's some great action bits in it, and it's great. And it came out a really good home video release. So check that out. It's fantastic.
Sitting on the counter behind you is that Mr. Alonso Duralde has been super looking forward to this,
and it arrived after he left Venice.
It arrived during his time in Venice. I'm going to wait until he comes home to watch it. But it does come out on DVD in a very short amount of time. Reached behind you with the paper. I may be jumping the gun on this.
Oh, it comes out at the end of the month. You got some time.
Oh, okay.
But it's a preview.
This is a preview.
On September 29th on DVD, you will be able to purchase...
Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films.
Canon Films were wonderful.
They were wonderful. And it's my recommendation for you for the end of September. If Alonzo Duralde were here, not only would we have watched it already, mm-hmm. because it arrived in the mail yesterday, but he would forbid me from talking about it until the end of the month because he's a stickler for those kind of details. Mm-hmm. While he's gone, however, I do what I want. And so I'm recommending this without even having seen it. And the reason is because it's got Charles Bronson and Dolph Lundgren and Jean-Claude Van Damme. And
We got Stallone. Well, here's the thing. It's got all the big faces on here.
Yeah.
It's got, like, because, you know, Canon Films did Superman 4 and destroyed the franchise.
There's an insert shot from the Apple on the back.
Yeah.
Which is one of the extra Linoleum Knife episodes that you can purchase for $1.99.
Yeah.
From linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
But, like, as much as they're pushing all of the big names on here, the best Canon stuff was the stuff that wouldn't get made today, or if it would, it would be made straight to video and only come out in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
Like, it's... I know that's not a country. Shut up. Anyway, my point is... my point is that they basically...
It used to be a
If you're an American and you know what a ninja is, Canon Films is the reason.
It's because of Canon.
They're the ones who made that a thing.
Yeah.
All right? American Ninja, all of those movies. Ninja 3, The Domination.
Right.
Like, all of these things, these are very, very much this very cheesy, very in-your-face, often very masculine, very exploitative, very murka, you know, action, sci-fi junk.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic.
I know what's going to happen. He's going to come home, we're going to watch this, and he's going to want to talk about it all over again on the show.
Do it. Well, we haven't seen it. We don't know about the documentary.
Which is what we will almost certainly do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not going to read any letters because I'm not going to read any letters because it's...
You ran through all the letters, didn't you?
We recorded an extra episode this past week, clearing the decks of all letters.
Yeah.
So that's out there to be listened to if you listen to the show. The episode that is entirely driven by you, the listener. And so I'm sure there are some in the Linoleum Gmail.
There's probably like one or two.
But I haven't checked because I don't do that. That's Alonzo's job.
Well,
he sends them to me. I read them. We discuss them.
I'm 90% confident that anyone who sends in a letter or an email wants you and Alonzo to read it.
That is correct.
Me.
That is also
correct. I'm very honored to be part of your podcast. I am merely a placeholder.
So the other things that Alonzo Duralde does, like tell you other podcasts to listen to, I don't know where that list is, so I'm not going to do it.
I can think of one other podcast you should be listening to.
Which one should they be listening to?
They should be listening to the B Movies podcast.
That's true.
Which is available on iTunes right now. That is the podcast I host with my co-host Whitney Seibold. Every week we have new movie news and reviews.
Yeah.
And also whatnot. We have commentary tracks that we do, much like Dave and Alonzo, but we do ours for free.
Yes.
But we don't do them as often as you do.
We like money.
You do like money. We have guests. We've had a lot of great guests on this
last
year.
We've made dozens of dollars.
Nice.
From those extra episodes.
Nice.
It's pretty great.
Yeah. But like, who have we had recently? We had like the Brothers Dowdle, the guys who directed No Escape. They came on and talked about that movie for an hour, talked about a lot of the issues you had with it. So that's a good one. I'm trying to think who else. We had Joshua Oppenheimer.
What did the Dowdles say about those issues?
They did their best. My point is, we've had Joshua Oppenheimer from The Look of Silence. He came in and talked a lot about that movie. So there's really good stuff on there.
So you have people who make good films come on your show.
We do. Okay. We try to emphasize that I actually liked No Escape.
I don't understand you.
That's okay.
All right.
That's okay. So please check that out. You can find me on Twitter @WilliamBibiani, and the show is on Twitter @BMoviesPodcast.
I'm on Twitter. I'm a D. Leland White.
Damn
on
right.
Twitter. Linoleum Knife is on Twitter. I believe we are Linoleum Cast.
Yes.
Twitter, yeah.
Yeah. Twitter @twitter.com/
linoleumcast. We're on Instagram, the same thing, linoleumcast.
Yeah.
Everything is, you know, if you've listened to this show before, you already know all these things. So we're done.
Yeah.
Thank you for being my co-host. I don't know how to make a podcast happen unless someone else is helping me do it.
That's literally the only reason I'm here, is that I'm the one who is available who knows how to, like, put things up on Libsyn.
There's other reasons, too.
Here's the thing. If other people could do that, there's a decent chance I wouldn't be the person you're with.
No, not true.
Okay.
You're my other husband.
Aww.
Yeah.
Michelle, you're okay with that?
Totally.
Technically, he was your second, actually. No, you were your first.
Woo.
That's right.
I've
known her for longer. That's normally he would technically have first dibs. So Dave, really,
I have seniority.
You do.
Wow.
Quel romance.
Okay, we're done.
I am Le Bibian Noise.
Le Bibian Noise. Goodbye.